Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
You gave them the old razzle-dazzle. You razzle-dazzled them. You gave them an act with lots of flash in it. Made them believe you were compassionate. Gave them
Greetings, this is podcast number 20 of Blast the Right. I'm Jack Clark from therationalradical.com, www.therationalradical.com. Today we have two segments. The first segment is about social Darwinism. To the extent any right-wingers still have a conscience left, and to the extent any right-wingers pay any attention to the death and destruction they cause, social Darwinism is the concept that allows them to assuage their conscience. In the second segment, utilizing audio clips, we'll expose yet another propaganda technique of Bill O'Reilly. Let's get right into it. Those of you who've been listening for a while know that I've said on more than one podcast that I consider most right-wingers to be like serial killers that have the personality of sociopaths. That is to say, they, one, have a complete lack of empathy for others, and two, seem to derive some joy, some happiness, some thrill in causing others to suffer. For a full exposition of this concept, go to my podcast number two. Now, some on the right-wing path haven't totally descended to this level. You might call them right-wingers in training. They still have a flicker of conscience left. Well, what do they say to themselves? They certainly don't say to themselves, "Oh, I have no empathy for others. I like to see others suffer and die." No, they say to themselves that, "I do have empathy and I don't like suffering and death. It's the fault of the poor themselves that they undergo this suffering and dying. And my policies help them." Now, if you don't believe me that this is how some of these right-wingers think, first, let me give you the academics on it. And second, I'll give you a bit of some real-life email I've received. This is from a recent article that Robert Reich wrote. He's a professor at UC Berkeley, and he was recently Secretary of Labor under Clinton. I'm going to read this excerpt instead of paraphrasing because Reich is very succinct and I couldn't say it any better than he does. He writes, quote, "Social Darwinism was developed some 30 years after Darwin's famous book by a social thinker named Herbert Spencer. Extending Darwin into a realm Darwin never intended, Spencer and his followers saw society as a competitive struggle where only those with the strongest moral character should survive, or else the society would weaken. It was Spencer, not Darwin, who coined the phrase survival of the fittest. Social Darwinism thereby offered a perfect moral justification for America's Gilded Age, when robber barons controlled much of American industry, the gap between rich and poor turned into a chasm, urban slums festered, and politicians were bought off by the wealthy." Close quote. Sounds an awful lot like today, doesn't it? Let me continue, quote, "It allowed John D. Rockefeller, for example, to claim that the fortune he accumulated through the giant Standard Oil Trust was, quoting him, merely a survival of the fittest, the working out of a law of nature and a law of God." End of Rockefeller quote. The modern conservative movement has embraced social Darwinism with no less fervor than it has condemned biological Darwinism. Social Darwinism gives a moral justification for rejecting social insurance and supporting tax cuts for the rich. In America, says Robert Bork, quote, the rich are overwhelmingly people, entrepreneurs, small businessmen, corporate executives, doctors, lawyers, etc., who have gained their higher incomes through intelligence, imagination, and hard work, close quote. Any transfer of wealth from rich to poor thereby undermines the nation's moral fiber. Allow the virtuous rich to keep more of their earnings and pay less in taxes, and they'll be even more virtuous. Give the non-virtuous poor food stamps, Medicaid, and what's left of welfare, and they'll fall into deeper moral torpor. End of Robert Reich excerpt. So as Reich lays it out for us, it hurts the poor to help them, and helps the poor to take away what little help they receive. Ah, a philosophy to soothe the conscience of a greedy bastard if I ever heard one. This brings to mind one of my favorite quotes of all time. Noted economist John Kenneth Galbraith so nicely summed it up when he wrote, quote, the modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy, that is, the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. Close quote. The search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. Tell me, does that not perfectly sum up everything that comes out of a right-winger's mouth? This social Darwinism that Herbert Spencer dreamed up and that modern right-wingers have adopted. I imagine that the right-wingers in training, they actually believe this and they use it to assuage their conscience. And the full-fledged, full-blooded right-wingers who have descended fully to the level of sociopaths and who feel no empathy for others and who enjoy causing others to suffer and die. When they spout this social Darwinism poppycock, they don't believe it. They're just throwing it up as a smokescreen. As a distraction. Okay, now that we have an academic background, a framework for the right-wing blame the poor propaganda, how does it play out in real life? As Reich pointed out, John D. Rockefeller justified the wealth he accumulated through his Standard Oil Trust by calling it, quote, merely a survival of the fittest, the working out of a law of nature and a law of God, close quote. And you know what? That's not much different from the email I get from right-wingers today. Listen to this one.
No, the poor receive discounted food, free or discounted housing, free or discounted energy, and free health care. Now that I think about it, what else is there but gas to get to work? Oh, most of them don't work. That leaves clothes, toiletries, and cigarettes. They are the largest smoking population. Their choice to smoke cost the taxpayers, not themselves, billions of dollars a year in health care costs. So much of poverty is self-inflicted by stupid choices that many make. Let's push the poor's envelope and encourage them to better themselves.
Wow, talk about a feeling of moral superiority. Wow. And of course, these right-wing social Darwinists blame this situation on the Democrats. Listen to this, the same person wrote.
No, the Democratic Party loves a financially dependent voting population, the poor. They love to provide social assistance at the expense of those working, with no real plan on breaking the dependence. Keep them poor and keep those votes. This liberal party is deteriorating the moral structure that this country was built on.
What's especially amazing to me is that this vicious, anti-poor, I'm morally superior to them type attitude isn't just evinced by the right-wingers of the secular mode, like the person I just read. No. Right-wing pseudo-Christians, fake phony Christians, they say much the same thing. This is what one of them wrote to me.
No, I won't go into trading Bible verses with you, but suffice it to say that Jesus said there would always be poor. The Bible also says, in a nutshell, if you don't work, you don't eat. Personal responsibility is not a concept that liberals tend to understand, much less embrace.
So there you have it again. Blame the poor. They don't want to work. And it's the fault of liberals. How to respond to this? I'd say something like the following. Your words show a frightening level of mean-spiritedness, as if everyone hungry on earth is hungry because they simply don't want to work. How many people do you really think that applies to? Is there anyone who would rather starve to death than work? What about the children who are starving? How does that apply to them? What about the people slaving away in agricultural fields who don't earn enough to feed their families, but are picking the food for you to feed yours? Why do right-wingers always assume the poor are healthy adults who refuse to work? Ranting on and on about welfare bums is a total straw man argument. That's not whom we're talking about. We're talking about people who are starving, or who are gravely ill without access to medical care, or who work full-time at backbreaking labor but are still hungry because their wages are so low. And again, what about the children? Are they lazy bums who refuse to work? Did they make bad choices in life whose consequences they now must live with? Your words evince an air of moral superiority completely unwarranted, because in reality, no one works harder than those who pick our crops from sunrise to sunset in sweltering, pesticide-contaminated fields, or those people who work two full-time jobs in what is still often a futile attempt to make ends meet. No one. Demonization of the poor is certainly something that you right-wingers excel at. For those of you right-wingers who consider yourselves Christians, let me leave you with this warning voiced by the late Pope John Paul II. It's addressed to people just like you. Quote, "It will be necessary, above all, to abandon a mentality in which the poor, as individuals and as people, are considered a burden, as irksome intruders trying to consume what others have produced. The poor ask for the right to share in enjoying material goods and to make use of their capacity to work, thus creating a world that is more just and prosperous for all. The advancement of the poor constitutes a great opportunity for the moral, cultural, and even economic growth of all humanity." End quote. Pope John Paul II understood that poverty is caused by injustice, not laziness. He wrote, quote, "The poor are becoming ever more numerous, victims of specific policies and structures which are often unjust." Close quote. He wrote elsewhere, quote, "One must denounce the existence of economic, financial, and social mechanisms which, although they are manipulated by people, often function almost automatically, thus accentuating the situation of wealth for some and poverty for the rest." Close quote. I was thinking, since it was Herbert Spencer who came up with this concept of social Darwinism, Maybe we should call these right-wingers Spencerians, or Spencerites, or Spencerists. Of course, if you did so, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. But right-wingers usually never know what you're talking about, because you'd be using facts and logic. Facts and logic short-circuit a right-winger's brain. Their brains are hardwired to react favorably only to the type of lies and propaganda that activate the purely emotional parts of the brain, that let them feel hatred, anger, and moral superiority towards others. Ultimately, it's kind of hard to argue with such people, isn't it?
To kind of catapult the propaganda. In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again. Kind of catapult the propaganda. Catapult the propaganda.
Let's discuss a right-wing propaganda technique that I call misrepresenting the nature of your sources or of your guests on a program. If you say a guest is a liberal or a conservative, people will then assume they know where the person is coming from and will evaluate what the person says accordingly. If the liberal says something that's not something a liberal would usually say, then people are going to go, oh, even a liberal is saying that. We should give that great weight. Along those same lines, if you say a guest is nonpartisan or from some nonpartisan organization, then people listening will also tend to give that person great weight because they'll assume he has no axe to grind. What a propagandist will do is mischaracterize his sources, mislabel his guests, and throw the normal assumptions of his listeners askew. Askew in a way that benefits the point of view that the propagandist is trying to foster. Twice in one recent program, Bill O'Reilly used this propaganda technique. The first example involves a supposedly nonpartisan guest discussing the AARP organization. I'll play the O'Reilly clip and interrupt as necessary to make comments. I've condensed and switched around slightly one or two parts here to make it more coherent.
In the Impact segment tonight, what has happened to the AARP? A few months ago, I noticed the organization was becoming increasingly radicalized, embracing a variety of left-wing causes. Now, they have named Harry Belafonte one of the AARP's Persons of the Year. As an entertainer, Mr. Belafonte's top-notch is a social critic, well, you decide. He said on September 22, 2005, that America oppresses people and wrecks the planet. On June 10, 2004, he said, quote, I'm aware how vast America's villainy extends itself because I see it in the faces of the wretched millions who make up poverty globally. Belafonte has called Colin Powell a house slave, has praised Fidel Castro, and has called President Bush evil. Joining us now from Washington, Peter Ferrara, senior policy analyst at the Institute for Policy Innovation, a nonpartisan think tank.
Remember that description, a nonpartisan think tank.
Just a short time ago, we got this statement from the AARP, which is afraid to come on the program. It says, through our cover stories and the Impact Awards, we recognize those who have made an impact on our world, like Governor Mike Huckabee of Arkansas, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, Michael J. Fox, and Harry Belafonte. The Impact Awards are not about ideology or an endorsement of political point of view. They simply recognize American citizens who try to make the world a better place. You know, Harry Belafonte doesn't get more radical than this guy, but he does do work for the United Nations. He is interested in poverty causes. What do you think?
So O'Reilly tells us that the guest is from a nonpartisan think tank, the Institute for Policy Innovations. I can't argue with that. The guest is a nonpartisan guy. We're going to have some dispassionate analysis. Just the facts, ma'am. Numbers and dates, solid evidence. Okay. Let's listen to Mr. Nonpartisan.
Well, this is par for the course for the AARP. They claim to be a seniors group, but they don't represent seniors. They represent liberals. Now, they're always in favor of higher taxes. They're always in favor of more government spending. They're always opposed to tax cuts. They're always opposed to reducing government spending. And you can go up and down the whole list.
Gee, the first words out of Mr. Nonpartisan's mouth are attacking liberals. Liberal bashing. The AARP is liberal. Liberals are no good. This doesn't sound too nonpartisan to me. Does it to you? Does it even to you right-wingers who may be listening? Let's listen some more to Mr. Neutral Analysis.
They fail to represent the interests of seniors, but they're always in there working hand in glove with all the liberals.
So Mr. Nonpartisan tells us that the interests of seniors cannot be the same as the interests of liberals. Tell that to all the seniors who are surviving and escaping poverty because of that horrible liberal program, Social Security. Back to the propaganda fest. Propaganda Palooza, anyone?
All right, so you feel that it's a committed liberal organization. I can't argue with that.
Oh, O'Reilly's surprised that his guest feels that AARP is a committed liberal organization. O'Reilly can't argue with that. As if he didn't know what the guy was going to say. Guests are pre-interviewed by the producer, and this guest was obviously chosen exactly for the views that he's expressing here.
They have a stranglehold on millions of Americans, seniors, who aren't liberal, who aren't radical.
O'Reilly engaging in his usual idiotic hyperbole. Yes, the AARP has a stranglehold. It forces seniors to join it.
And you know, there are now conservative alternatives to AARP, and the average American should look into those.
Ah, now Mr. Nonpartisan pushes alternative organizations to the AARP that are conservative. He wants people to join a conservative group and not a liberal one. That's very nonpartisan. And now check out this Potemkin Village wrap-up between Bill O'Reilly and his nonpartisan guest.
I just think this is beyond the pale.
And it is.
It really is beyond the pale. This guy Belafonte.
Extremist nutcase.
Right. I wouldn't call him a nutcase. I say to you, is he a committed anti-American person? Ms. Ferrara, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
After hearing Mr. Nonpartisan speak like this, I said, I'm going to go to their webpage, his organization's webpage, and see what it says. It says, quote, advocating lower taxes, fewer regulations, and a smaller, less intrusive government, close quote. Sounds pretty straight-line right-wing to me. Nothing liberal there. Nothing nonpartisan there. I imagine O'Reilly might try to weasel out of a propaganda charge here by saying, well, he said it was a nonpartisan group. The guest didn't say anything about Republicans or Democrats. Now, under one definition of nonpartisan, O'Reilly might be correct. The Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary defines nonpartisan as free from party affiliation, bias, or designation. However, that definition is not really what people think of when they think of as nonpartisan. This is the American Heritage Dictionary definition. Based on, influenced by, affiliated with, or supporting the interests or policies of no single political party. Well, by that definition, certainly, this gentleman and his organization are influenced by and supporting the interests and policies of the Republicans. An audience being told that a guest is nonpartisan assumes he's going to give neutral analysis. This guest was certainly anything but that. In the second example, O'Reilly does even worse. Instead of mischaracterizing a partisan guest as nonpartisan, here he mischaracterizes a guest as the exact opposite of what he is.
Unresolved Problems segment tonight. Should Stanley Tukey Williams be put to death in California? The one-time leader of the Crips gang, Williams was convicted of murdering four people in two robberies. He's been in prison since 1979, sentenced to die this December 13th. But the NAACP and many others want his life spared by Governor Schwarzenegger. Joining us now from Los Angeles, Joe Hicks, Vice President of Community Advocates, a civil rights organization. So what do you think about this Williams guy? Should he be put to death?
This guest is from Community Advocates, a civil rights organization. I never heard of them, did you? But let's be fair. Let's listen to what the gentleman has to say.
Well, Bill, I think after 20-some-odd years, the wheels of justice should turn here. There's absolutely nothing that indicates that this man should be granted clemency based on anything I've seen.
Wow, a civil rights guy calling for the execution. Execute the bastard, he deserves it. This isn't the usual position of civil rights groups. This guy must really deserve execution if a civil rights group thinks he should be killed.
The question is, why are these limousine liberals arguing that his life has been redeemed when he absolutely refuses to apologize or be remorseful for his acts?
Even more amazing, here's a civil rights guy bashing limousine liberals. So that must make the guest a non-liberal, a conservative. He's a conservative civil rights guy. Isn't that an oxymoron? Let's go to this group's website and check it out. Check out this civil rights organization. The chairman of the group is Richard Reardon, the former Republican mayor of Los Angeles. He's a likely person to head a true civil rights organization, isn't he? Let's look at the mission statement of Community Advocates, Inc. It's titled, Redefining Civil Rights for Los Angeles in the 21st Century. It says in part, quote, the time has come to rethink approaches to civil rights that focus primarily on complaints, rather than dwell on ethnic, racial, sexual orientation, and religious victimization. We should build an identity-transcendent civic culture, develop cooperative enterprises, and celebrate common interests. Convincing people that they are victims of discrimination perpetrated by others will only encourage further retreat into the ethnic enclaves that characterize our city's geography. End of quote. So you see, the group that O'Reilly labeled as a civil rights organization is actually an anti-civil rights organization. It's an organization that says there don't need to be any traditional civil rights organizations, because that's the wrong approach, because those problems don't exist anymore. Those bad limousine liberal civil rights organizations convince people that they're victims of discrimination. Without those bad liberal civil rights organizations, we can build an identity-transcendent civic culture, develop cooperative enterprises, and celebrate common interests. How sweet! A group of right-wingers basically asking us all to form a circle and sing Kumbaya. So there you have it. In just one program, O'Reilly labels a liberal-bashing right-wing ideologue from a liberal-bashing right-wing ideological organization nonpartisan, and then he describes as a civil rights organization an organization that doesn't think there need to be civil rights organizations. So the next time any right-winger gives you a statistic, or you listen to a right-winger present a guest on a program, or a right-winger cites what somebody says to you, delve very deeply and carefully into the nature of that source, because it will often be the exact opposite of what the right-winger is portraying it as. Well, that'll about wrap it up for today. As I always say, if you liked what you heard, please tell your friends about Blast the Right. If they don't know about podcasting, turn them on to that as well. An alternative is just send them the link to my podcast homepage and tell them to put their email address in the FeedBlitz sign-up box. They'll get an email notice of each new podcast, and they can listen to it by just clicking on the title of the podcast. Links to the sources I use in the podcast can be found in my data resources page, linked to off the main podcast homepage. Music credits. We opened the podcast with a little bit of You Razzle Dazzled 'Em by Bill Jacobs. He's at billjacobs.us. The bumper music was Catapult the Propaganda. Nise Music, nisemusic.com. We'll close with about a minute of Taking My Country Back by Honky Tonkers for Truth. Thanks to listener Claire from Scotland, we now have a link for Honky Tonkers for Truth. It's too long to say here. Just go to my music resources page, linked to off the main podcast homepage. There you'll find a link to some background about the song, as well as a link to download the tune. So, until next time, I'll sign off and say I love you all, including all you right-wing pieces of crap.
We had a bundle in the treasury drawer, more than there had ever been before. But every day we're drowning deeper in debt. Maybe 4 years should be all you get. Then you gave tax breaks to the millionaires, and you tried to make the working man pay. But you can't tax a man when his job's not there. Now look at where we are today. Hey, I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Well, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You got too many fancy friends for me. The Saudis treat you like you're royalty. You blew the budget and you bossed. Understand.